So yesterday, David gave string theorists a list of questions that cosmologists would like answered, and today, Steve will answer them.
Unfortunately, I'm going to do so in such an obscure way that I don't think any of you will be able to decode the answers. But it is true that David Wands reminded us yesterday that understanding cosmological singularities is one of the key open questions facing us in string and M theory, and especially those aspects of the subject that are trying to talk to cosmology. This is a difficult question. I'm not exactly sure I know why it's difficult, but some of the reasons are that it's a problem that's intrinsically time dependent. You have this big thing, the Big Bang, happening, and things really change in time. It's not just some little ripple in time. And we still don't understand string theory very well in strongly time-dependent situations. And second, it's almost certain that these are intrinsically non-perturbative phenomena. All kinds of stuff happens when you have all these enormous energies, things collapsing and exploding. And although we do have a lot of understanding about certain aspects of non-perturbative string theory, our most fully developed non-perturbative formalisms, these brain bulk correspondences that matrix theory and ADS-CFT represent, are not well suited to this problem, roughly speaking, because they can't handle this violent time dependence very well. So people have made ingenious attempts, and there's some knowledge coming out, but it's not sort of pouring out. On the other hand, in contrast to this rather gloomy situation, we can look back with great pleasure at the enormous progress that's been made in understanding another interesting gravitational phenomenon in string theory, which are black holes. And there, we really understand a lot, certainly much more than we did, say, 10 years ago. And then further, one might jump quickly and say, well, if one falls into a black hole, I don't know if any of you have, well, we might all be doing that, but we're not sure. If you did and you started getting near the singularity, it would feel a lot like encountering one of these cosmological singularities, a big crunch. Things would start getting really unpleasant. And so if you understand black holes, why don't you understand something about these cosmological singularities? All right, and that's the kind of circle of ideas we're going to struggle with today. Unfortunately, the powerful techniques that we use to think about black holes in string theory are, I guess, holographic would be the word that summarizes them. And what this means in practice is that they really only describe things happening outside the horizon, as far as we can tell. And unfortunately, the singularity happens to be inside the horizon. Okay, and that clash is what makes getting information about singularities from black hole techniques difficult. Okay, for instance, let me just remind you, the state of the art in understanding black holes and string theory probably is ADS-CFT techniques. Here is a spatial sphere at infinity in some anti-de Sitter space. You put your famous conformal field theory, this would be like the Super Yang-Mills theory in ADS-5, cross S-5. And then you heat it up. You either actually put it in a thermal bath or you pick a representative state that looks roughly thermal. And looking into the bulk, you see some hot thing that is a big black hole. And the correlators that you can compute in the conformal field theory, these gauge theory correlators, correspond in the bulk to distant observers looking down on the horizon of the black hole. So they're almost manifestly outside the horizon kinds of observables. Okay, now this is a very good story. There's a lot to learn. There's a Hamiltonian for this conformal field theory. Time evolution is unitary. You don't lose quantum coherence. In some cases, you can compute the entropy. It's really, a good story, but it is intrinsically an outside the horizon story. Okay. All right. So this would seem to be sort of hermetically excellent, but useless for understanding this question of what's inside the horizon. Some of my colleagues would say that is the situation, and I should stop talking now, but I won't. All right.
What is the technical reason why you cannot extend inside the horizon?
Well, there isn't. Well, no. If you actually, I mean, probably the most conceptually attractive thing would be to build some little, I guess rocket is the typical vehicle that's talked about here. So if you could understand how to make things localized in the bulk of ADS, okay, then you could ask, you build this little rocket and you could ask what happens as the rocket falls or shoots or whatever it is in. But it's our lack of control of localizing things in ADS that prevents us from at least trying to ask that question. Okay. All right, and so the things I'm going to talk about today are essentially shortcuts or hacks to try to get around this basic limitation. Okay. All right. Well, this is not quite the whole story. And in fact, a number of authors, including some people in this room, have talked about ideas to try to extract some information from behind the horizon in ADS-CFT. And there's important earlier work by Balasubramanian, Simon Ross, who used to be here, Maralf, who I guess is here now. Okay, well, all right. In a more generalized sense, I guess. And Luco did some important early work that will have some relation to what I'll say. The actual framework that I'll talk about and what I'll be discussing is work of my student Lukasz Fiedkowski, Matt Klibon, Veronica Hubany, who used to be here, who was a postdoc at Stanford, and myself. It follows from a framework that actually Juan Maldacena suggested as a way of extracting more juice from this setup. And what Juan suggested was to think about the eternal black hole, let's say in anti-de Sitter space. I'll draw it, let's say for D equals 3, I'll draw a Penrose diagram. It looks something like this. I'll just remind you what these things are. This top squiggly line is the future singularity. This is the thing if you fall into the black hole you eventually hit. Okay, this is like would be like sort of like a big crunch. Okay. This is a past singularity that is a little bit like the Big Bang, what is it called, a white hole. These are horizons. All light rays travel at 45 degrees on these diagrams. These are boundaries at infinity where space looks like anti-de Sitter space. Okay, and it's interesting that in this eternal black hole that lives forever, you have two boundaries. I'll call them boundary one and boundary two. And such a bulk spacetime has a conformal field theory dual, as a number of people have pointed out. The natural dual is to have not one conformal field theory, but two, one for each asymptotic ADS region. So you have conformal field theory one and conformal field theory two. And you can imagine putting boundary correlators here. They essentially see just one outside of a black hole. It looks just like a ordinary thermal situation we described here. Technically, what happens is you trace over the degrees of freedom in the second conformal field theory, and that gives a density matrix, which is a thermal ensemble for this remaining conformal field theory. Okay, so you can this reproduces all known information here, but there are other observables. Observables is there are other things you can compute, okay, that involve operators on each side, okay, and in some vague sense that we'll make more precise later, this correlator in the bulk is telling you something about what's happening behind these horizons. Roughly speaking, if you think of a path integral to compute this propagator, some of the paths naturally go behind the horizon, and sort of, and you know, maybe some of the ones that dominate, in fact, do. Okay, so it's these new observables that we're going to focus on. Okay. Now, I should talk a little bit about what these mean. First of all, these two points are space-like separating. Okay, so there's no real information that's going to flow from one point to another. We're not used to, in string theory, thinking about good, that is, like gauge invariant quantities corresponding to space-like sort of off-shell separations. Okay. Usually you have to compute something like an S matrix that corresponds to on-shell things. In anti-de Sitter space, that's not necessary. These boundary correlators are bulk diffeomorphism invariant, even though the separation can be space-like. Roughly the rule is anything that's sensible in the gauge theory, and this is pretty sensible, this is just a correlator in one in these gauge theories, is a good diffeomorphism invariant thing in the bulk. Okay, so the space-like separated thing that you might think you weren't allowed to compute, okay, is not obviously ruled out by any gauge invariance issue. Space-like separation is important because that lets you go through the horizons, things that are causally related to each other. Once you're inside the horizon, you never get out. Okay, so it's this kind of off-shell thing that still seems to make sense, and by make sense, I mean you can compute in the gauge theory in a sensible way. That might give us some extra leverage.
The distance always non-zero in any 2 points?
I'll tell you that the answer to that in a minute. Okay, the answer to that is interesting and surprising. Okay. Let me, and just for orientation, let me also say that I've described things that you need two copies of the gauge theory. That's really not necessary. You should think about this space-time as this is coordinate might be indexed by some Schwarzschild time, which is the gauge theory time of this gauge theory. Okay, think about complexifying this metric. So you sort of have Euclidean Schwarzschild's time as well as Minkowski's Schwarzschild time. So you have like a circle running like that as well as this line. Okay. Now, as you know, black holes are periodic in imaginary time, so the circumference of this circle, okay, is beta, or I beta, where beta is the inverse temperature of the black hole, okay? But you can also see then that you can get sort of from this boundary to this boundary by shifting by half a period, okay? So you can compute things, involve an operator on this side by computing operators on this side and shifting by half a period of imaginary time. Okay. There's a slight technicality that time runs this way here and this way here. So if you put an operator here, it shifts up to this. Okay, but that's a technicality. All right, so really all that's required to compute these two-sided correlators is to compute on one side, one copy of the gauge theory, and then don't study ordinary correlators with real Minkowski time arguments. Compute these funny correlators where some of the arguments are shifted by I beta over 2. Something that would be ridiculous from the point of view of the gauge theory. You would never want to do this. Okay? But from the bulk, it has a natural interpretation. So in some sense, from the gauge theory point of view, we're talking about some very funny correlators. Okay? Okay, so now you have to ask, want to ask a little bit more about what information is in these opposite side correlators. Well, Per Krause, Horacio Guri, and I started investigating the situation in D equals 3, and we did a number of things, and I'm only going to tell you about, in some sense, about the simplest thing, really just an exercise. And it's actually parallels a previous calculation that was done by Moralf, Luco, and Ross in what's called the Gion geometry, which is some orbifold of those things. And that is to say, let's take this two-point function. Let's say we're in, okay, and let's consider an operator that corresponds to a bulk particle of mass m, and m goes to infinity. And now let's try to compute that in the bulk. Well, if you have a very massive wave operator, okay, basically it's dominated by geodesics. So let's compute the geodesics in this geometry. In three dimensions, the geometry is very simple. It's called the BTZ black hole. It's basically an orbifold of ADS space. Let's compute this geodesic, which looks something like this. Penrose diagrams don't really, this doesn't mean anything, but it means something. Okay. With a particular choice of, all right, and it's not quite that unpleasant looking. So there's some geodesic. And in the geodesic approximation, the two-point function of two operators, let's say with Schwarzschild time t symmetrically, is given by e to the minus the mass of the particle times the proper length, remember this is a space-like geodesic, of this path. So you just compute this geometrical path, compute its proper length, and you regulate it. This is really an infinite length, but you have an infinite amount of ADS space here. Cut it off the way we usually do in ADS space. okay, which is like renormalizing the C of T. And then the question is, you have some function of T here, and you can compare it. There are exact answers known in BTZ. And do you get the same answer? To order 1 over m, yes, you do get the same answer. So in some way, you can dress this up and say, if I computed this exact thing, I get some information about geometry behind the horizon. I get the lengths of certain geodesics. If I went up to this time, geodesic doesn't curve as much, and this is even straighter, and so on. This can be computed directly from conformal bound 1 plus 1 dimensional conformal field theory techniques. And then the idea is to compare that to the geometry. Yeah, well, it turns out it's much simpler than that. All you have to know is that it's a two-point function of a conformal field theory. So it just uses two-dimensional conformal field theory principles. It's very silly. That's basically right. Yeah, I think that's it. This side is approximate. No, I think you can get it exactly in conformal invariance. At finite temperature, the two-point function is given by the two-point function on the cylinder. Why? I want to go in the large black hole limit.
Okay, the large black hole limit is
not. Okay, sorry. Okay. So you're right, it's an approximate expression, but I've taken that approximation parameter to its limit. Okay. Okay, so this is not very impressive, but it's a cartoon at least of how one might want to proceed. Now, I mean, one of the things that makes this not very impressive is that the behavior of these geodesic distances, as you go higher in time, which means you're coming closer to the singularity, is featureless. It's a very mild thing. Nothing happens, even when this thing is, like, you know, very, very close to the singularity. Basically, that's because the geometry is an orbifold geometry. And an orbifold has constant curvature except until you hit the singularity. So you never really see something dramatic. All right, so this led us to, and us being Lukasz, Veronica, Matt Kliban, and myself, to try to do something similar in a higher dimensional situation. Look, in D greater than 3, and most of the time D equals 5, where the geometry is quite different. There, the singularity is not an orbifold singularity. It locally looks like a Schwarzschild singularity. Again, Schwarzschild, as I'm sure you know, as you take some Schwarzschild coordinate to 0, as you're going to the singularity, the curvature goes to infinity. So you have this big power law divergence of curvature. And that should, and in fact does, affect the geodesics dramatically. So if the geodesics are dramatically different, their lengths will be different, which means their correlators were different, which means the gauge theory will be doing something different. Okay, so that's the idea. The idea is to find this pattern embedded in the gauge theory. Okay. Yeah. Okay, so there are two ways. One would be to take two copies of the conformal field theory and one operator in each. Okay, and then if you wanted to just take one copy, you take a correlator. This is in TO of T of minus T plus I beta over 2, thermal. So you shift by half a period in imaginary time. And so this thing is some f of t, and you compare that to this quantity here. So this is a correlator in a thermal gauge theory. Yeah.
But that's not what you calculate.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is
built in. This notation means an opposite side correlator. You can put, there's a symmetry that lets you shift as you want. I'm taking them at symmetric points, but that's the real, what this really is delta t or something. It's implicit. It gets into various. Well, it actually doesn't, because we're in the large black hole limit, which means the temperature is very large. So the beta dependence goes away. Beta goes to 0. Yes, that's right. Yeah. No, there's no non-trivial beta dependence. I mean, it scales because we've scaled out, right? Right. Now, you can do all this in the finite beta limit. I mean, the only thing you don't have is you don't have closed form results to compare to. I guess that's a feature, not a bug. I mean, but all right. So this is the thing that you'd compute in one thermal gauge theory. Okay, you take two things at t and minus t in Minkowski time, and then you shift one of the arguments by half a period. Very peculiar, but that's what you're supposed to do. All right. So now let's revisit this geodesic situation in d greater than 3, where you have this real power law curvature singularity, and you expect things to get bounced around, and it's really quite different. And it took us a while to sort this out. So rather than derive it for you, I think I will just draw you a picture, because I'm such a good draftsman. All right. So this is what happens. I'm going to draw the Penrose diagram for d, let's say d equals 5. The first thing that is unfortunately true that took us a while to understand is that the Penrose diagram is no longer a square. These are the singularities. Okay, the Penrose diagram, it depends on how you do it, this is one appropriate representation. This again is the future singularity, and this is the past. And then there are these 45-degree, that's not a 45-degree line. It's true for what? It's true for d equals 4 ADS Schwarzschild. Yes. Yeah, this is ADS Schwarzschild. It's unfortunate that something like this, which should be in every textbook, isn't. This depends on. In terms of. It's an ADS scale. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's an interesting question. You might have thought so, but we're going to use something that looks like it gets sub ADS probing because the particle is so heavy. Okay, so here's what happens when you start. Suppose you have two points on this side and you ask what geodesic joins them. That's the geodesic that joins them, big surprise. Okay, but now, suppose you go down here, then the geodesic goes up and comes back down. It actually comes up above the midline. It should be symmetrical. And if you go down further, it goes like that. And as you hit some particular value of Schwarzschild time, you can see that with this kind of funny tops and bottoms, that a 45-degree line can bounce off the singularity and come back. So in answer to your question, there is a null line that connects these two points. Null is a loose, almost null, you know, except for this point. But very small proper distance. Yeah. I don't know the explanation. It's arithmetic. I mean, it certainly is the case, but I can't tell you a simple. There's a minus sign when you do an integral, and
I take the one that goes. You're saying the geodesic that connects these guys.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. No, this is Minkowski space, so it's not shortest, it's saddle point. So that you can't think in terms of minimizing. I'm sorry?
No other saddle points?
No other real saddle points.
I'm just confused why since they intersect, I can't have another saddle point where I go to the intersection point and then go up and then go down.
Oh, well, these don't meet in a smooth way. You'd have a kink in the path. And that's that. You're not supposed to do that.
These are, you say, saddle points being
constant. We construct them. You just solve the minimization equations. The idea is you're trying to dominate. Yeah. You don't. The only thing you do is you follow the set of non-singular things, and you regard that as a limiting value. You don't actually try to understand that singular curve independently.
There's only one saddle point? Coleman?
There's one real saddle point.
How do you know that's the right saddle point?
It won't be the right saddle point. Okay. Right, right, exactly.
This picture has nothing to do with the answer.
Oh, it does. It does. Right. It is a small lie in the service of a greater truth. Which I'm sure as director is a principle you've used many, many times. I know I do. Yeah, so to say a few more words, the way you actually find these is you imagine Schwarzschild coordinates R as a function of some affine parameter S and T as a function of some affine parameter S. You write a Lagrangian involving the Schwarzschild metric, and you write down equations of motion coming from that Lagrangian, and it, as you might remember, usually what happens is you get a mechanics problem for R of S. So think of S as a time, and R as some coordinate, and you get some energy function, E squared equals R dot squared, plus some potential V of R, where this comes from the metric. In fact, it's minus the warp factor. Okay. And so you just solve this one-dimensional mechanics problem. This potential turns out to be very repulsive. For space-like geodesics, high curvature is repulsive. And so to get near the singularity, you have to have a large amount of energy. Okay? To have a large amount of energy means that the velocity, R dot, is very fast. That means you cover the path. The change in S from beginning to end is very short. But the change in S is the change in proper length. Okay, so that means that to get near the singularity, you have to have a very short proper length. Okay, and that's what's happening here. In D equals 3, there is no strong repulsive barrier, so this doesn't happen. Okay, so this real pattern really reflects the difference. Now, just for a minute, I will, in the interest of, what's it called? Honesty and full disclosure, I will repeat my answer to David's question. This geodesic is not the thing that dominates the correlator, but suppose it were. The proper distance, this value here, where the thing becomes a light, a null ray, is some TC, might have a minus sign, which is equal to beta over 4 for D equals 5. It's a pure number in the natural scale of the problem. Okay. All right, and then L of T looks like 2 log of T minus TC, near TC. Here we've regulated this proper distance by subtracting out the infinite positive distance to the ADS wall. So we've subtracted a big positive thing. This thing goes to minus infinity when the geodesic is null. So a correlator e to the minus logarithm, 1 over t minus tc to the 2m, an enormous divergent power law. So if this geodesic dominated, the gauge theory would have to do something spectacular here. It can't. Okay. Roughly speaking, these points are separated points in the gauge theory. There are no singularities at separated points. I'm afraid it took me a little while to appreciate that point. That's right, exactly. So this, in fact, this is roughly the way in which you get conformally invariant power laws. What's different here is that it comes from these opposite side. Okay, so it turns out this geodesic does not dominate the correlator. It does not lie on the steepest descent's integration contour, even though it's a perfectly good saddle point. Okay. But it will play an important role in the story. Okay. So we now first have to figure out what is the real answer for the correlator. It turns out that there's some other complex geodesic that dominates. Okay, and it turns out in hindsight this should have been obvious, but it wasn't to us. So how do we find that? Well, it turns out one efficient way is to use the fact that the theory is analytic in time, in this boundary time. And so let's calculate where we really understand everything in Euclidean time. So let's imagine So let's imagine we have a beginning point of a geodesic path here, and an end point somewhere around in Euclidean time. So this can be computed in complete Euclidean language. Sometimes you might recognize this better if I draw the Euclidean path like this. This is sort of the cigar that you're used to. And there'll be some geodesic on the cigar that will give the answer to this Euclidean correlator. It's something you can compute in the gauge theory. It's unambiguous. The smallest distance path is the one that dominates. There's something over real paths. There's none of this integration contour nonsense. Okay. And we can... No. No, I mean it sometimes it goes over the tip. But that's all. And then once we know that answer is a function of Euclidean time, we have Lorentzian time going this way, and we have IT Euclidean that way. And this turns into an answer involving T equals T Lorentzian plus IT Euclidean. We get an answer we know on a finite strip, and then we can analytically continue. Now, occasionally, one saddle point might switch places with another one. It could be piecewise analytic. But we were smart enough to figure all that out. Okay. And the way the answer works is the following. So that you realize that there are actually some formulas in this work. Okay. The result for this proper length is a function of time, where T is this complexified time, and it's really T final minus T initial. So it's really the difference in times here. And zero when the points are antipodal. That's zero. Okay. With that definition, you find a set of coupled equations that determine the proper distance, L of T. One is down here, log of minus a half e squared and then the proper, and E here is basically this energy in this mechanics problem, but now you have to think about it as a complex parameter, and L is equal to log of 2 over the square root of 1 plus 1 quarter e squared. These two equations determine L as a function of T, as an analytic function. And that this analytic function essentially determines this two-point function precisely, suitably interpreted. Okay? And a lot of the rich structure I'm going to tell you about is contained in these formulas. Okay? And in fact, things like information about the black hole singularity is contained in this formula. So, yeah. Yes. Again, this isn't the large black hole limit.
But your T critical was beta over 4. So when beta goes to 0, the T critical is basically at 0.
Well, I'm sorry. You measure. Yes, I've made a change of notation. We rescale T and measure it in units of not quite of beta, but of R plus, the horizon radius. Okay, so then that's what the T over here is. So I should have probably, this T is really the factor of pi in converting between the two. But yes. Okay. All right, well, now we can actually see what happens to this correlator. when t is small, it turns out e is small. So we can simplify these equations and write, turns out t goes like e cubed, and l goes like e to the fourth. So those equations are hard to solve. These equations are easy to solve. And you find l goes like t to the fourth thirds. This is very weird. Remember, the correlator is like e to the minus m l of t. So this says the correlator is branched at separated points. That's usually not, that can't happen. But in fact, this is a correct statement. What it means is that there are, in fact, are at this separation, when t is zero, there are three geodesics that coincide. I've drawn them sort of distorted. But it turns out that when you pull things infinitely far apart, they have the same action. And when you have multiple geodesics, you have a situation called, what's it called, a caustic? Okay, and then you can have, at infinite m, that is an infinite value of the saddle point parameter, you can have something that's non-smooth. And any finite value fluctuations between them would smooth out the limit. Okay, so that's what this reflects. Okay. At infinite m, it's given by this.
So is this an asymptotic
in 1 over m? Asymptotic in 1 over m. Yes. Yes, that's right. No. This is fine. This is exact in t. Now there's a little bit I have to do. You're doing a saddle point approximation. It's going to turn out that every now and then saddle points are going to exchange dominance, and you're going to have.
So saddle point is m.
That's right. It's a saddle point. So yes, it's like.
Did you have to put in the determinant?
No, I haven't done the one loop determinant yet. And in fact, at this point, it would diverge. At this caustic, it would diverge. But it wouldn't generically.
But isn't that important for you? I mean, gives you...
Actually not, no. It's all right. So, but now we can get a feeling for what we expect. So now let me plot on the complex T plane some properties of this proper length function. This is T Euclidean. It's the imaginary axis. This is T Lorentzian, the real axis. We can compute here. We know, because it's Euclidean space, the proper length is real. End of story. No messing around. But we see the function is T to the 4/3. So as we come down and try to evaluate what the action will be for Lorentzian time, we know it's complex. Because t to the 4/3, when you rotate by 90 degrees, picks up a complex phase. What that means, you can follow the geodesic. The nice real geodesic in Euclidean space becomes a complex geodesic. And the thing that dominates is a complex geodesic. So when you actually want to now calculate the answer as a function of Lorentzian time, that is, if you want to move these things up and down and get the real answer, it turns out you have to sum over what's just above here and what below. There's like the branch cut in the t to the 4/3 should lie along here. Okay, so basically you have something complex and you add its complex conjugate. Okay. As an important check of that, we can say, we know this for all time. So we can say, what is this two-point function as a function of time? Okay. Now, you know that when you compute correlators and black holes as a function of time, the long-time behavior is described by the quasi-normal modes of the black hole. In fact, Herzog and Son here wrote a very nice paper explaining the relationship of that of those quasi-normal modes to what happens for this opposite side formalism, this what's called thermal field formalism. And it turns out it's just the same quasi-normal modes dominate. So we can just take this formula, go to large T, I won't do the arithmetic, and you can read off what the behavior is. And in fact, you find an infinite sequence of exponentials that both oscillate and decay. And so you get an infinite sequence of quasi-normal modes. And they exactly agree with the large M values computed by Nunez and Starinets for this black hole using very elaborate techniques on the formidable Hewn equation, which is the radial equation in this black hole. It's a differential equation about which little is known. Well, that, I shouldn't say that. There's lots of books about it, but there's not enough known that I can penetrate any of it. All right. So this is a non-trivial check that this is the right choice of branches and so on. And in hindsight, the fact that the quasi-normal modes are complex tells you that no real geodesic could have dominated this correlator. Yes?
So if you had chosen the branch that fell out on the negative real axis, you wouldn't have gotten the right quasi-normal modes?
That's right. You would have gotten only half of them. Branch cut is a little bit misleading in that, what's happening is the saddle point, there's a change of dominance of saddle point here. Okay, it's like this piecing together of analytic functions. It turns out this is like, it is like going to the other branch of this function. But you should think about it more as a change of saddle point.
So you're from, maybe summing over all the saddle points to have e to the L.
Right.
The cut plus e to the L below the cut.
That's right, because they have the same real part at right here. And so therefore they have the same size. And if you went below, one of them would be exponentially small compared to the other.
How could you dispose of the other contribution?
This one?
Yeah.
Yeah, good question.
We seem to blow out.
Right. It turns out we've actually studied the integral examples, how this works. If you're not on the saddle point contour, if you're not on the steepest descent contour, an enormously more favorable saddle point gets canceled by some other rapidly oscillating things. Yeah, this was confusing to us, but that's because we hadn't taken the right course. Right. That was one of the examples. Right. It turns out, actually, the laboratory we used is we've studied for very small t, there's a soft mode because of these geodesics that are nearby. So the functional integral is sort of dominated by just keeping that one soft mode. So it reduces to an ordinary integral. Okay, and by studying that ordinary integral, we were able to see a lot of this behavior. That integral turns out to be what's called Pierce's integral. Okay, which is like Aries with an x to the fourth, not an x cubed. Okay. Okay, so it's what the name of the integral? Yeah, I'll write the. I have to get my glasses out, I'm sorry. So the model where you is you take some integral that's a function of tau, and tau is t Euclidean equals the integral dx from minus infinity to infinity, e to the minus m, the saddle point parameter, v of x, where that depends on tau, and v of x is equal to 1/4 x to the fourth minus tau x. So if that were a cube, I think this would be Aries integral. Okay, and this thing is called, the place to learn about this, if for some reason you feel like that, there's some very beautiful papers by Michael Berry, which you can find on the net, where he, you know, incisively analyzes this behavior. And so this integral, you can find the saddle points, it basically mocks up this behavior precisely. You find this nice saddle that looks like that, that doesn't contribute. But you'll also see in a minute that you also can find the saddle in the way that I will describe in a minute. Okay. All right, so in some sense then we know the answer. We have this sort of piece of analytic function. It jumps into another piece. It's really the complex conjugate branch. And it turns out there's another exchange of stability line on the other side. These are called anti-Stokes lines, if you guys are into a Stokes line means something that's much more subtle. But these are called anti-Stokes lines. But now we have to ask, well, where is this? I mean, why did I waste your time explaining that? Well, in this analytic function, the place where L gets logarithmically minus infinity clearly is when E gets very big. Then this goes like log of E. Okay? But in this analytic function, there must be some t that makes e big, and that will make l big. So somewhere in the analytic function l of t, somewhere in some sheet, somewhere, there has to be a place where l of t has a logarithmic singularity. And here's where it is. You go around 90 degrees, then you go on, instead of jumping onto this other branch, this other saddle point, you keep going on this branch. So you go into the metastable phase, if you will. Okay? And you go around and continuing on that phase, you find at, I guess, minus TC here, okay? You find a behavior where L of T goes like log of T minus TC. Maybe this is plus TC here. Now, an important point is that this is computationally accessible. You can calculate, let's suppose you could calculate anything you wanted in the gauge theory. Let's play that game. That's far from true, but okay. Then you could compute, let's say, 1,000 power series coefficients right here and extrapolate them past this first order phase transition and say, what's happening down here? Okay? And in fact, what you'll find is this singularity. In fact, we did something like this with 10 non-zero terms. You can find this thing to a part in 10,000. And so this information is there in the gauge theory, is there in the correlator. It's clear that this logarithmic singularity is directly related to the curvature singularity. Okay? And furthermore, it is something you compute directly in the gauge theory. So in this sense, I think maybe this is a central point. There is something you can compute in principle in the gauge theory that is directly sensitive to the black hole singularity.
Don't you have to worry about whether the saddle point analysis which picked up saddle point was justified by taking n by infinity?
You want me to worry about 1/m corrections?
Yeah. I mean, what justifies this analysis?
Well, I mean, so first of all, you can take m very, very large. The thing that, I mean, in the gauge theory, the only thing that limits you in taking m large is
then
the...
I pick out the saddle points which occur on the physical sheet.
Well, no, I mean, you could compute in complex time. You could track this saddle point, okay? And the claim is that all you have to do is then continue this saddle point to find this. So this is something that you would calculate in the gauge theory.
Yeah. Leading term in the mathematical extension.
Right.
So that's the same.
Yes. It's like going through, it's like doing a, continuing into a metastable phase or something like that.
But you don't think there's any danger?
No, I think in this case...
Analytic continuation.
Right. Right. Right.
And you also have another limit, which is n plus infinity.
Right. And
exchanging those two.
I think I see the question you're asking. I think you're asking, could the number of terms I need to compute grow with m? Okay, that doesn't happen. Okay. We've looked into that. And for instance, at leading order, the number of terms you need to get good resolution is m independent. We can estimate the 1/m corrections. Okay. Essentially, the 1/m corrections are just given by heat kernel expansion.
Well, I mean, for example,
yeah.
Yeah. That changes the analytic, can change the analytic.
Right, and we've looked at that. All it does is it put a pole or a branch cut that you can easily continue around.
But not on the same relaxes.
Yeah, it's right here. It's a t equals zero.
But don't you have to go through, worry about going through that branch cut as well?
No, because it's you know you have a it's a function of a complex variable. You can go around it. You know where it is, and you can stay away from it. That one's very easy because we understand its properties completely. In fact, I mean, that's an interesting thing, that if you take the 1/m expansion, I'll just say a word or two, you take 1/m corrections to these answers, and just in terms of computing propagators, you're doing a heat kernel expansion. And you get things like 1/m times curvature, that the paths are moving in, okay, raised to various powers. Okay, and so these 1 over m expansions are relatively small, except when t is very close to tc, when the geodesic is coming close to the high curvature region. So in fact, what you find in 1 over m is high, when the smoke clears, you get something like 1 over m t minus tc squared to the k is what the 1 over m corrections look like. So going to higher orders in 1 over m, you get even more singular behavior at tc. Just that's just saying that when you compute 1 over m fluctuations, it's more sensitive to the high curvature region. Oh, exactly. It certainly could. It probably does. But you can extract each order. I mean, because you don't have to be at TC. You can say, you know, you can stay a finite distance away. And so this is interesting, because if you take one, k is equal to 1,000 or something, then you can build functions that have a 1,000 order pole. This makes quite a substantial bump, even on the physical sheet. And so you can find something that in principle you compute on the gauge theory that would have an enormous feature that would be hard to explain, I think, from the gauge theory, but would have a rather natural explanation from the black hole singularity. Right, exactly. But that's good. That's good. Right? That's a feature, not a bug. Right? Yeah.
Why did you have to take this beta goes to zero limit?
No, just for arithmetic.
Just for convenience
in algebra.
Everything you say could have been done with.
Yeah, I think actually something might happen at particular values of mass. There could be changes in behavior. Although I don't know the answer to that. But certainly for large but finite mass, nothing happens. I think actually in an appendix in our paper, we give the formulas for that. That's just purely for algebraic. As you can see, the algebraic complexity is already substantial. Were there other questions? Okay, let me just go on by talking about other. Yeah.
If you did this for, let's say, finite m and.
Finite m, okay.
Well, let's say finite m, this continuation would not be well defined.
That's right. And so you have to measure what it is. Roughly speaking, suppose you define the computation by computing here and computing 100 terms in the power series. Okay, that's what you mean by the operational definition. What you'd have to worry about is you have this other saddle point here that here is subleading but gives an e to the minus m probably times RADS or something, contamination. So what you have to have is that this has to be much smaller than any quantity you're looking for. Suppose you were trying to compute some non-perturbative 20 d brain annihilation cross-section, okay, that goes like e to the minus 20 over g string. This thing better be smaller than that. In fact, that's an important constraint, that because at finite g string, the biggest mass that's easy to obtain in a particle that does not back react is a wrapped d brain, which will be something like some number over g string. Okay, so this thing, which will go like e to the minus g string also, it will limit the accuracy of things that you can compute to something of order e to the minus something over g string. In fact, I think you can put a lambda, a TUF parameter here, if you work with giant gravitons. And so, in fact, you can make it parametrically smaller than the d-brain, like if you wanted to compute d-brain, anti-d-brain corrections to the metric, which I guess should be there. What you would be able to do this by analytically continuing, you'd have to compute something rather small, but big enough budget. Okay, and parametrically, the contamination of this other saddle would be ignorable. But for certain things, it will not, and that's, I believe, the key issue.
So operationally, I take any operator I want in the gauge theory, I calculate its two-point function, analytically continue it, and I'm going to find somewhere an enhancement which I won't be able to explain, and that is going to be the signal.
Yeah, maybe operationally I'll say it's sort of as a caricature, I will accept that. But something like that, yeah. I'm not sure that every operator will do exactly. For instance, here's an operator that you might take a large mass particle that's a highly excited string state. Okay. Now, all the calculations I've done, I didn't mention it, but I should, were in the limit of alpha prime going to zero, the supergravity limit. Suppose I turn back on alpha prime by making it lambda the Tuff parameter finite instead of infinite. Then a highly excited string state is going to blow up into this big cloud. And then none of this reasoning about geodesics and stuff the things you really need to do are these D-brain states that are localized. Yeah.
But for this to be interesting diagnostic,
yeah.
Don't you need to know something about what happens to some statement about what happens generically for Green's functions continued to unphysical sheets?
You mean in order to see that this is peculiar?
Yeah. Or, what do you know?
Well,
if I find a singularity, what do I do?
Well,
you said, ordinary real time, you can use spectral properties,
right?
Locality. But on the second sheet,
I agree with that.
Our behavior, how do I distinguish black holes from other?
Well, for instance, by taking the 1 over M expansion. I mean, I think the fact that the 1 over M expansion...
Is there a theorem? I mean, can you prove, for example, in the 1 over M expansion, that something about analytic properties is a nice method? You need to have some background for...
Yeah, I
for a signal that you have to know what the landscape looks
like. Well, I think... I appreciate what you're saying, and I don't have information like that. One thing we've tried to do that's a little bit related is we tried to look in the weakly coupled Yang-Mills theory at similar quantities where, you know, one could try to explicitly compute rather than have theorems. There, things are very strange, things are not strange, I should say. This branch cut at t to the 4/3 is a really rather distinctive thing that has a natural explanation in terms of the supergravity, this coalescence of geodesics. To any order in perturbation theory, we can't find it. And I'm not surprised. So the only thing I can think this means is that as a function of a Tuff parameter, this particular quantity, which remember is the infinite mass limit of a correlator, okay, of a...
Which operator are you looking at?
Okay, so I'm sorry, I haven't been precise. The best operators are the ones, let me see, in ADS5 cross S5, N equals 4 super Yang-Mills, are the SO6 BPS-like states of charge Q that correspond to roughly the wrap, what do they call, giant gravitons. These are wrapped D-brains, and so in the lower dimensional space, we'll have the nice point-like D-brain, razor-like quality that we've come to admire. I don't know. I can't figure out, are they determinants or products?
They come particularly abundant for the tremendous thing to be a determinant.
Okay, take that one. No, wait a minute. That's the max. I maybe want to be able to vary Q continuously, and you can't do that. So maybe.
And then it's not clear which one is which.
Okay, so maybe can I take a tenth of the maximum Q and take products? Is that okay? All right. So something like that. So something like trace of phi q times. Yeah, right. Okay, that's the best operator. Okay. And so we tried to compute this in weak coupling, and nothing happens, not surprisingly. So I think this means as a function of a Tuff parameter, in the limit, so we're always at n equals infinity. We're always with zero g string. Okay. As a function of a and then we take Q going to infinity, there has to be a phase transition where out here there's a branch cut and out here there's not. Now this is, this doesn't mean that the theory itself has a phase transition. It's a very peculiar operator that's jumping. But I think that is a consequence of our analysis. And now we can write down metrics that, that evolve from the supergravity metric with some kind of stringy corrections where this geodesic coalescence goes away. So from the bulk point of view, it's not shocking that such a thing should happen, but it's very surprising. It also is very irritating because it means we can't use weak coupling techniques to get any insight into what's going on. Now, if Joe would stop being dilatory and you'd get your integrability stuff done, we could just compute the boundary states for this thing, and we could just watch it as a function of a Tuff parameter. Why not finite temperature? Do you think that's going to stop the integrability that destroys the symmetry? It's okay? See there? So what's your problem?
Okay.
So, all right.
You just have to crack the rope with one we're doing the other is a bit harder.
Yeah. You might very well. I just haven't. Yeah, I haven't thought about that, and that would actually be very interesting, of course, because then you have control at weak coupling, and so, but I haven't thought through that very much. There's this general issue of black holes in this plane wave background that is very mysterious to me. So. All right, but then the idea is you know being able to do this and find this from an analysis of the classical metric, well, it points you where to look. But the interesting thing to me is that now you can compute, you can go away from the supergravity limit, you can study things at finite alpha prime, and again by dimensional analysis, the first kinds of corrections you expect are alpha prime times some curvature raised to the k. If you turn this into t minus tc language, I think this is what 1 over the Atuf parameter to the 1/2, 1 over t minus tc to the 1/4 raised to the k power. So again, you expect in a power series in the Atuf coupling, higher and higher order singularities near tc, again reflecting the fact that alpha prime will have a more important effect in the high curvature region. This is not a proof, but this is the generic thing to expect. The first correction to the metric has been computed by Igor and some other people. Okay, and of course it behaves like this. And there's a dilaton dependence too I haven't fully understood and stuff. So, but the really interesting thing is you don't have to just do a power series in lambda. You could evaluate it for lambda equals 100. Okay, and you can ask what the finite alpha prime behavior is. Okay, does this pole, do these higher and higher singularities mean the pole is shifting? A student and I, Jared Kaplan, just played a game and the warp factor in ADS Schwarzschild looks like 1 over R squared. That's the Schwarzschild singularity in 5 dimensions. We said maybe that goes to 1 over R squared plus alpha prime. You know, it smooths out the singularity. No reason to think this is correct. But if you do that and do this geodesic analysis, this pole, or this logarithmic singularity, splits into two off the real axis. All right. So, you know, you might think that part of the question of what it means to resolve the black hole singularity, that word is loaded, has to do with what this singularity is doing in the presence of alpha prime and quantum effects.
Could you ask a question?
Yeah.
What you're doing is doing a large M expansion.
Yeah.
Which is localized in geodesic.
Yes.
And then you're going through branch points to pick up a geodesic that doesn't dominate. Right?
Yeah.
Which is the geodesic you want. Is there some mathematical way, Greg? you're trying to reconstruct the potential landscape from the asymptotic expansion of that alpha. You're really using analyticity somehow to get to a fake alpha. But if you know every term in the asymptotic expansion, can't you sort of recover the landscape itself, which is the full metric? If you actually knew the solution to the gauge theory, which would be more than this.
All you would have to know is that the analytical.
You mean the quantum gauge theory? You knew the full solution?
It's integral.
Wow. Did you know that, Joe?
No, but for large M. So if you knew the solution to the gauge theory, you'd know that as well. And presumably you could construct the whole metric.
If you knew the solution to the gauge theory, you wouldn't be doing
it. No, but you want to go back and construct the bulk property. The solution of gauge theory.
Holy shit. You really, the large N gauge theory is integral.
about Battlefront approximation, yeah. About geodesics in the Gulf, from which you could plot the whole market.
I'll tell you what, if we actually had that information, I would work really hard to reconstruct as much. I bet you could do a lot, but it's getting the information that's the hard.
Well, the idea is that use
I'm sorry, use PADE?
There are theorems about if you have
but I want to go back and now reconstruct the landscape, which means reconstructing the whole country, which determine the desert, but also away from the desert. I don't want to.
Well, I mean, it's in the spirit. I think David's asking in the spirit of these. Can you hear the shape of a drum? That is knowing a certain quantities for, about the Laplacian, the large M kind of limit.
Can, answer is no.
Right.
Because. Well, this isn't exactly.
Yeah, right. This is a different set of ingredients. The issues about studying finite G string are more subtle, and again because of the phenomenon I said, that the mass, the biggest mass that you can study is like lambda over G string. And the contamination when you have a finite but large mass is like e to the minus the mass times some ADS. So you can calculate things to accuracy something like this. And so if you're trying to compute certain non-perturbative effects that will get enhanced at the singularity, where you start computing them, they better be bigger than this. So all kinds of deep brain phenomenon stuff are okay, but let's say a Nova-Schwartz e to the minus 1 over g squared might be hard to find. This is a little irritating, and I think I don't quite know what piece of information is encapsulated in this data. It strikes me it might be a little bit like a double scaling limit, although I'm aware that as you get old, you tend to repeat yourself over and over again. You know, there's some scaling limit. You take G string very small and you take T very close to TC. And the things that survive in that doubled limit are the things you really can learn about from this technique. But I don't have a good answer to that question. Just as an example, as a final example though, just to stress how much truly non-perturbative stuff you should be able to learn if only you could compute in the gauge theory. Imagine you took, you know, couple of operators like an operator creating a charge Q, and suppose this thing can fragment, this wrapped D brain can fragment, because it's not exactly BPS here, into charge Q1 and Q2 that add up to Q. So you have two operators, let's say right on top of each other, Q1, Q2. So this completely non-perturbative effect of a wrapped D brain falling apart and then rewrapping as two smaller radius D brains. It has to be non-perturbative, involve ripping world sheets of D brains, all kinds of crap. Okay. It probably gets enhanced near the singularity just because it's a more interesting environment. Okay. This thing could be computed from this three-point function by analytically continuing to the singularity. And this is the kind of information, this is much more than knowing like what the metric does. Okay, and so again, it seems that somehow what's going on in this procedure is we're using in a very strong way the analyticity not just of the metric, but of the quantum theory itself. The gauge theory, the boundary theory, all kinds of stuff is analytic there, involving non-perturbative bulk phenomena. And that strong, that analyticity allows one to extract a large amount of information about the singularity. Of course, I'll leave you with the depressing thought that we've talked about already. We don't know how to compute anything in this gauge theory. Well, I guess maybe except a set of measure zero. And that makes all of this, the utility of all this, something that is unclear to me. So I'll stop there. Thank you. Yes, Steve.
So, you had a dynamical black hole that formed.
Yeah.
Black. You think there's
Yeah, we actually are thinking about that. And the usual thing one says is in a collapse metric, the metric's not analytic. Okay, you know, you join an outside metric to an interior metric and da 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 da. Okay, so all these analytic tools are well, it's not clear how to use them.
But
in the gauge theory, in this ADS-CFT setup, that's not as obvious. You certainly can prepare a black hole by collapse, as you all know. You prepare a large cloud of gluon energy and let it evolve and do something. But then in that, you could compute the correlator of a couple of these probe heavy particles. It will still be analytic, even though it's not in a thermal ensemble. It's just some, multi-point function in the gauge theory. So there is some analyticity. In particular, you can compute this peculiar half period thing that has no real meaning in the collapse metric. And so what we're trying to struggle with is, what does that really mean? We don't know if there's some kind of complexified metric. So what you compute on the other side is not exactly real. It's kind of almost real. And it's got to approach, you'd think, because, an almost thermal state has got to approach what you computed in the thermal thing in some way. So I think there might be interesting things to say there, but we haven't gotten ourselves straight on it yet. Yeah.
I have a question about causality.
Yeah.
With a collapsed black hole, the area behind the horizon is causally separated from infinity, and you'd be surprised you could ever see anything.
Mm-hmm.
Here, if I understand the way the flow of time works, the person on the right can shine a flashlight on the singularity, and the photons will hit it and bounce out forward, and just be seen as forward moving photons to a person on the right.
Yeah, I actually get confused about it. Gary straightened me out definitively. You want to repeat what you told me?
The fact is that even, all of these black holes stay in time. There's a future direction, which is the same. It's absolutely the same. There's a universally agreed upon future direction of the light coming. It points up on these diagrams on both the left and the right. The only thing which happens is that there's a symmetry, which happens to be a future directed time-like symmetry on the right and a past directed time-like symmetry on the left. So the fact that the natural coordinate moves in the other direction has to do with the symmetry, but there is a universally agreed future time-like direction.
Universally agreed by
within the bulk.
This is a time-oriented space-time, which means there's a consistent choice of future direction. And if you start in one point and choose your electrons to go up and consistently, continuously extend that vector space, now they're going to point out everywhere. So there's no sense in which future directions change.
Let me.
There is no question. Okay.
All right. Okay.
So since you've got both a white hole singularity and a black hole singularity,
yeah,
can't you just look at the white hole singularity by ordinary terms with a telescope or something? I mean, by some very mundane means, and just see what's happening there?
I don't think that happens.
There'll be particle production from it or something or not.
Yeah.
There'll be some state coming out of there. Even in the existing state, there is some initial state.
Yeah.
Which we could try to characterize. Okay, so that's the answer.
But I think actually that gets to part of maybe the question. You might ask, in this causality thing, why are you going to learn anything? Like how can any of these space-like things be non-zero? The way space-like correlators are non-zero, as you know from flat space quantum field theory, is because there's pre-existing information coded in the state in which you take a vacuum, in which you take an expectation value. And so what you're measuring is something about those pre-existing correlations. You might say, how interesting is that? I mean, those pre-existing correlations. But the point is that those pre-existing correlations will eventually time evolve into a black hole, okay, or came out of a white hole. And so those correlations will, we hope, contain some information in them about the black hole singularity, even though there's not a way to shoot true information out. That at least is the
statement that what you're learning about the singularity is associated with the white hole?
No, I don't think so. I think I mean, depending on which time you look at, the geodesic bounces up or back. I mean, you can get both.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, it seems what's interesting, and this is is that for these very heavy particles, there's certain information available that is sub ADS. It's these very heavy particles that travel on geodesics. That's right. And this is used in some of the attempts to study flat space S matrices, roughly speaking. You study certain operators that can study things below the ADS scale, if I understand correctly. Now, well, I know, all right. I believe this is one of these examples. And Gary and Veronica produced another, where by studying certain tails and special things, you can probe things that are sub-ADS. This idea that you can never probe anything sub-ADS, although it's, I don't know what's the word, it's morally correct. There are little... okay, good. All right. Thank you. All right. But I mean, okay. That's right. It's got many of the same features. Although it doesn't back, these don't back react, but it's got some of the same features. But I think that this business of the distance between the singularities as ADS scale is going to make like building a generic ensemble of or a rocket ship that falls in out of ADS material quite challenging. But I mean, one will have to. Well. Well,
you learned something. Aren't you learning something? You learned something about the
ballpark. That's right. I mean, you know which singularity the geodesic is going near, whether you're positive TC or negative TC. I mean, there you know you know rather precisely where the geodesic is going. Why is that? Well, I mean. Oh, you mean because the TC is. Just scale that out. Measure everything in units of beta. That will be our unit of time. Okay. It's a conformal field theory, roughly on the boundary. Roughly, the large mass limit means you can ignore the fact that the thing is a sphere. Okay. And then it's a conformal field theory in infinite space, so temperature doesn't mean anything. Okay. You know. So you just measure ratios of things to temperature.